from powerlineblog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierengoff, and Stephen Hayward.
That was easy.
Hi, everybody. It's Steve Hayward for the Powerline Show. That was my big red button I keep on my desk. I have one just like President Trump, except mine comes from Office Depot. And all it does is make noise. It doesn't actually end the world like his button does. I'm sure he got his from the Pentagon. Although I've long thought with other people that if there actually was a button on the president's desk, someone would long ago have set a coffee cup on it and blown up the world. So this is all pretty fun stuff. But I am thrilled today to have joining us on the Powerline Show one of my favorite human beings who I've never met in person because he lives over in Europe. And it's David Diebel, who's a stand-up comedian, frequent contributor to the Ricochet website, a brilliant commenter on Twitter, and you'll have to follow him there. We'll tell you about that at the end of the show. Anyway, good evening, David, over in Germany. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, and good morning to you, Steve. I'm happy to be with you.
So, you know, the temptation with someone like you who's so good at topical humor on Twitter and elsewhere is, sort of what's in the news? You know, we had this crazy business about Trump's huge button a few days ago, which is almost too easy and ridiculous to joke about. Here in California, I know you follow events in California. I think you get here once in a while. We now have legal weed, but plastic bags are still illegal.
That's right. Maybe we could dig a tunnel. Somebody could, I'm actually hoarding them up here in before I came to Germany. Because they're not anymore, they're basically contraband. You know, when I fly, I actually hide them in my weed. So.
For years, you may remember, Johnny Carson used to make jokes about weed whackers and leaf blowers in California. And I'm starting to think those two items are going to get very confusing for us.
That's right. Yeah, Johnny was actually a Democrat. You never know it, though, because he felt that, you know, people didn't want to tune in to hear his views on politics. And now, of course, you know, every late night show is the fraction of the ratings of Johnny's. And they're all preoccupied with progressive politics and they can't figure out why they can't get, you know, the huge, you know, audience that Johnny enjoyed. And gee, I don't know. Maybe half of Americans don't want to hear you, you know, slam their politics.
Yeah, you know, I want to come back to that point a little later in order, because I think that is I think you're quite right about how Johnny Carson used to be. I think someone once did a content analysis of his political jokes, and they were pretty much 50-50. Boy, that's sure not what you get now from the nighttime shows. But let's come back to that point. I want to do just a little biography about you.
Sure.
Where are you from? Where did you go to school? How did you get into comedy, and how did you get into stand-up comedy?
I grew up in Long Beach, California, in the Los Angeles megapolis, about 30 miles south of Los Angeles, 20 miles.
And, oh, so I'm from Pasadena. I didn't know you were
right. Okay. I didn't know that.
Sorry, keep going.
I've actually lived in Boulder, Colorado, where I believe I may have even lived there when you were teaching in Boulder. But I grew up in...
Oh, my goodness.
And so I grew up in Los Angeles area, and I was in a magic club, the Long Beach Mystics, and it was my local magic club, or at least that's what I thought of it as. I realize now it was actually, you know, arguably the best magic club in the country. It's produced, you know, some of the finest magicians over the last, you know, couple of generations, in Las Vegas and all around the world. And so it was a great place to grow up. There was a strong emphasis on performing and presentation, and I started doing magic, and then I got into juggling, and I started doing more stand-up and things like that. So now my show is sort of a hodgepodge of stand-up comedy, and I do a lot of the kind of bar tricks. I kick a billiard ball in the air, catch it in my eye socket. I roll a honeydew melon down my back and, you know, pierce it between my legs with a garden hoe. And then I start doing, you know, political jokes. So it's a bit of everything.
Now, did you study drama, or is this just sort of a hobby that became a profession?
Yeah, more of the latter. I haven't done too much. I mean, I've taken maybe an improv class when I was a kid, but it was pretty much just I'm a big advocate of just throwing myself in there. So I did a lot of open mic nights. I just got myself on every stage that I could get myself on. Of course, being in Los Angeles area, it was helpful. I did auditions as a kid, some commercials, things like that. But basically, after high school, I went to Europe. I did some street performing out here with a friend. Then I came back to the States and started doing comedy clubs and private shows. And then I started doing corporate events, things like that. Done a couple of late night shows and colleges. And so it's a bit of everything. I mean, I've, you know, kids' birthday parties, corporate events, and pretty much everything in between.
Now, I have to ask about college shows. Do you have to have a specifically tailored content so as to avoid getting into trouble when you go to colleges?
Well, yeah, that's just to get you in the door. It helps to have some sort of tale of woe. I mean, you do, they have these showcases where it's not enough, you know, if you're a comedian, it's not enough to make everybody laugh. You have to establish your progressive bona fides. So, for example, the last one I did, there was this, the last comedian on the last day, who was the big, obviously his reputation preceded himself. He did done all these college shows, I understand, in his introductions. And for, he comes out for 10, 15 minutes. He talks about how he suffers from, public anxiety disorder, which I guess is the preferred term for shyness. So, you know, everybody goes out there and establishes their victim credentials. And, you know, as a white male, it's a bit, I would have to go, you know, bend over backwards to try to – basically what's so frightening about these things. I mean, I know you were in academia and I'm not the masochist that you are, but the groupthink that prevails at these showcases where they send – you know, each university or college sends a handful of students to, say – you know, Leavenworth, Texas or something to watch the showcase and hire, tap various entertainers to come back to their university. And boy, you know, they're thinking about their entire, you know, they're making a decision on the behalf of the entire student body. And boy, that entertainer had better not only be good, but, you know, not have the wrong position on, say, healthcare.
Right. Right. Now, have you always been a conservative or is it something you came to in adulthood through experience and reflecting on the world?
I'm sorry, I lost you in the beginning of that sentence. Could you repeat
it? Oh, sorry. Yeah. It's have you always been a conservative or is it your current view is something you came to in adulthood through reflection and experience?
Oh, I think in comedy, for me at least, you have to be kind of a renegade, and the default position in show business generally, and I know now we're going back, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, tends to be liberal. I mean, there's a reason why the college circuit has never produced a really, you know, legendary comedian. I mean, can you imagine George Carlin coming up, you know, cutting his teeth on the college circuit today instead of on gin joints, you know, like he did. So I don't know. I guess I've got a contrarian speak and a contrarian streak in me, but also on the policies. Who knows why? I think the Iraq War was a big one. Hearing, you know, Harry Reid, you know, go on national television talking about how this war is lost. So that was my kind of coming of age politically. And of course, it just made sense to me on almost every issue. And yeah, I don't like being berated. I like, you know, one of the reasons I like Fox News is, as George Will says, it sings a discordant note in an otherwise harmonious chorus. And I just have a contrarian streak in me. And in my milieu, everybody's pretty much progressive.
Yeah. Now, you're currently living in Germany, and, you know, nothing says comedy like Germany.
I picked the wrong time to sip some water. That almost came out my nose.
Sorry about that. What is it? I mean, not to improve too much of your personal life, but what, I think you're married to a German. Is that why you're living over there?
Yeah, that's right. This is the hell that I am in, a stand-up comedian living in Germany. yeah, my wife is German, and we divide our time between California and Germany. So we just are on a a stint in Germany now. We came back last summer and we'll be here for 2 or 3 years. My wife has some work obligations. And when I'm in Germany, I do a lot of cruise ships all around the world. I'm off to Singapore in a couple weeks. I'm going to do a cruise from in Asia. And then I do some USO shows out here and then some private functions. If they're sufficiently lucrative, I'll head back to the US and do some shows in the United States. And then I do some expat shows. There are small gatherings of expats, English-speaking expats in Germany and, you know, from Germany and from Ireland and England and the US and so forth. And I'll do a smattering of those.
Yeah, I'm sure they're starved for some good comedy living in like an expat in Germany.
Imagine being Irish and living in Germany. Good Lord.
I just have to tell a quick story of my own about sort of on that point. Is I was giving one of my book tour lectures several years ago in Ohio and had a big audience, I think 250 people. And it's not a, you know, I have some jokes in it that usually killed. I've used them before. They work well. And I would give my predictable laugh lines, and the audience just sat there stone-faced. And I find it a little unnerving. I have to ask you how you handle when a joke bombs. But and afterwards, I asked my host. I said, "Gosh, I'm not sure the audience really liked me. I mean, I use some of my standard jokes that usually get a big laugh, and I got nothing." And my host said to me, "Oh no, they thought it was funny. They're just Lutherans. They don't laugh."
Right.
Okay. go ahead.
Yeah, well, a lot of that is just managing expectations. I mean, you can kind of tell. I mean, I say as a comedian married to a German, I sometimes have to go outside the marriage for laughs. So I don't rely on my wife for testing material. She's not much help in that regard because she is kind of typical German in that way. I mean, like sarcasm. They do not get it. I mean, their idea, they're at the love of comedy in Germany is – put a man in a dress, and that's comedy.
Yeah, and have an oompah band playing or something. Yeah,
right. But as far as audiences go, if they're quiet, you just have to stay calm and, like I say, manage your own expectations. I think the guy gave you good advice.
Yeah, I mean, I always find it a little unnerving when a line doesn't work. But then again, I'm giving a talk. I'm not performing for effect the way you are, someone like you.
Right.
Yeah.
That is a nice thing to you. My job is to make people laugh. And if there is no laugh, that's a big problem.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear you're coming back. You spend half your time in the States because someday we at Powerline are going to have some kind of weekend event and we're going to want to book you to be our evening relief from,
Yeah, I am flying through San Francisco, I know, in next month, and I sometimes anchor events to, when I'm flying. But I do appear pretty regularly in the U.S., and I would love to do it. I would love to meet fellow Powerline readers.
Yeah, well, one of these days we'll do it. I mean, whenever I talk about this, I get a huge response. And the problem is it's just the time to organize something. And my biggest problem these days is I don't have enough time for anything. But this would be worth doing, I think. So
yeah, maybe a nice counterpoint. Getting the podcast off the ground is the first step. An actual get-together. I can't imagine what would be involved.
Well, alcohol would be involved. That's one of the requirements.
Are you going to grill? If you're grilling at this meeting, at the Powerline gathering, I'm in.
Okay, I will probably do that. But I think it'd be a nice counterpoint to, say, perhaps Victor Davis Hanson, who can be a little doer.
I insist to go on before Victor Davis Hanson. That happens at corporate events a lot. They'll bring me up, after we're going to take a 10-minute potty break. And of course, if you're performing in North Dakota, which I do a lot, it turns into a 30-minute break. And the last, there's stragglers coming in throughout the show and, or they'll put on a Victor Davis Hanson type before me. Don't get me wrong. I love this guy. He's probably cranked out three columns during the course of this podcast, but
right.
He's very, what is the word? Academic.
Well, he actually can be quite, if you see him, he actually can be quite funny, but in a very dry way that, you don't, he doesn't smile either. He'd be a good German comedian. I'd put it that way.
So. Yeah. Right.
Well, talk a little bit about some of the you mentioned you make corporate appearances. What are those like? I mean, are you one of those type of speakers who tries to work in a little bit of, management advice or like some people do? Are you there purely for entertainment? And how do they differ from a normal audience?
Well, to answer the first question, I do two things. They're separate. I do them in tandem. I do my show like a typical corporate event. I'll perform my comedy for 40 minutes, and then I'll tell my story. And my story is about how I started out as a conventional juggler. I won the International Junior Juggling Championships when I was 13 years old. And it was always my goal, as strange as it may sound, to be one of the best jugglers in the world. But when I was 22, I was riding a tall unicycle through a doorway indoors. Bad idea. And I didn't duck sufficiently. I hit my head on the crossbeam of the door and fell off the unicycle. And I was fine. I was shaken up a little bit. Had a big lump on my forehead, which I had to ice to make the swelling go down. But I thought nothing of it. But the next day, I went to practice, and I noticed I had lost the coordination in my right hand. My right arm no longer was getting the signals that my brain would send it. And it's been exactly the same now for 25 years. So it doesn't really impact my life in any way, except in the one way that really matters. In fact, I remember one neurologist that I visited at the time who said that the problem is quite subtle, and that if you weren't a professional juggler, you probably wouldn't even miss it. I was like, well, that's great. If you weren't a neurologist, I probably wouldn't even be paying you. You know, I am a professional juggler. So that's how I started getting into the more of these, into more comedy, more stand-up, and doing more unusual skills that don't require me to recruit my right hand, like, you know, rolling the billiard ball in my head, or, you know, kicking a coin into my eye socket, things like that. So I tell that story, but I do it separately. I do the show, and then, you know, everybody's in a good mood, and then they're quite open to telling the story. I generally don't tell the story without first kind of softening them up a bit.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, the first time I think I heard you tell a story on a YouTube video, and at first I thought you were telling that. I mean, who bangs their head riding a unicycle indoors, right? This has to be a made-up story, but this really is true.
Yeah, it is true. And I mean, there are subtle other things. You know, I'll be putting away dishes, and you know, I give it this little flourish it doesn't need. But basically, the only thing it impacted really was my ability to juggle. You know, I used to be able to juggle five balls behind my back. Now I can't even juggle four balls in front of me. But in the long run, oh, it's been great, because it really, you know, it forced me. I was a professional juggler. That's how I made my living. And it was either sink or swim. And so I have to give myself some credit. I mean, I had a lot of help, moral support, and help from friends help me, you know, bouncing ideas, coming up with these goofy tricks that I do. And in the end, it's been a great blessing, because nobody really does what I do. I mean, people do stand up and people juggle, but people don't, you know, balance a coat hanger on their face and light a marshmallow on the hook and then let it eat it and things like that. So I like to say I'm the best at what I do because I'm the only one who does what I do.
Well, that's finding a great niche, and I should encourage listeners, if they haven't ever looked you up on YouTube, to see some of those, I guess I'll call them stunts. You still do juggle. I like seeing the juggling the plastic bags, which I think was a stroke of genius on your part.
That was, it was good. The plastic bags I can still juggle, of course, because they fall very slowly, but they are harder to come by. I mean, they are really cracking down, boy. I mean, at least in Orange County, California, I could cross the border, as it were, go behind the orange curtain and get some plastic bags, which had been banned in Los Angeles County for a long time. But now they're not even available in Orange County except at Costs. So I have to pay for them. They have dispensaries, basically, for grocery bags. So I'm hoarding them now, because if I run out of plastic grocery bags, God knows what I'll do for a living.
Yeah, you know what? I think they've been banned statewide now. I know there's a lawsuit about it, but I have a stash also. So if you run short, let me know, because I actually reuse them for things. You know, that's what I love about liberalism, is they're pro-choice except for plastic bags, your health insurance. Right. You can tell a very long list of things, right?
How do people clean up after their dogs in California now? I mean, that is one thing that I mean, you can't do it with a paper bag, obviously. I don't have a dog, so I don't know. But I guess people must hoard them as well. I mean, there's an entire underground economy, a black market for plastic bags.
Yeah, there seems to be one emerging, right? Let's go back a bit to something you already touched on, which is, you know, why comics, most of them, like Hollywood actors, are liberal. I mean, there are a few conservative comics of note, like Dennis Miller. Three or four others, Greg Gutfeld on Fox News. I don't know if he does stand up, but he's a very funny guy. And then there's you. And then you, as you mentioned, you've done a few of the late night shows. And gosh, they sure have gone. I'll give you sort of my theory on why the shows have moved hard left. I think it's because they're following the MSNBC model, which is the TV audience is fractured. So it's the best way to hang on to a core audience because if they try to actually appeal to a broader spectrum of the public, they might actually have a smaller – I'm not sure that's true, but they might have a smaller audience is their thought. But that doesn't get to the deeper question of why people in the arts in general end up being so far to the left most of the time.
Well, that's a good question, and I really don't know the answer. I mean, I have my theories. I remember reading a small little book that Peter Robinson wrote – back in the early 90s during the first George W. Bush campaign against Al Gore. And he asked somebody, why is Hollywood liberal? Somebody was in liberal. And the most prosaic answer is that it's a union town. You know, not everybody, believe it or not, if you go to Hollywood, you know, you're not surrounded by directors and producers. You're surrounded by key grips and makeup artists. And so it's a heavily unionized town. Another reason I think is just good old fashioned groupthink or, you know, peer pressure, you know, which wouldn't be unique to Hollywood. I mean, when I go to those, as I mentioned, those college showcases, you know, these are kids, so it's kind of defensible or understandable rather. But in Hollywood, you know, there's profound pressure. There's people who can do you favors. And if, you know, it's best to keep your politics quiet. As a conservative, you know, I'm not a very political person. You know, politics, I don't wake up. I'm not a seething hotbed of conservatism. That's almost, it's almost a, you know, a contradiction in ideas and terms. You know, so even when I do a show, when in my show, the only I can make oblique references to politics. I'll say how, you know, I'm a Los Angeles lifer, except for a short stint I spent in San Francisco, where I've was not only president of the Bay Area Republicans Club, but I was also the member, which is not a, you know, it's not a slam on progressivism. It's just a joke about the dearth of conservatives in San Francisco. Or I'll say, you know, I talk about being married. You know, I got married old school to a woman. You know, even progressives think, believe it or not, laugh at that. Right. Yeah, I think groupthink – it goes a long way, but you know, as for the ratings, the pursuit for ratings, I'm not really sure. I mean, Johnny Carson had more ratings than all of the late night shows combined, I think, and he was, you know, famously apolitical, at least during his monologue.
Right, right, yeah. Well, you know, people have been saying forever, will this ever change? And I suppose maybe it won't. I don't know. Let's see. What else should I ask you about? Gosh, I misplaced my notes here.
I'm trying to find your email.
Oh, okay. Well, we've gone on here a good 20 some minutes. We've got enough for a good show, yeah. I think. But so you're off on a couple of cruises.
Yeah.
But which cruise line books you the most often, or do you have an agent that places you?
I have an agent, so I'm all over the place. I'll be working lately. I've been doing a lot of Oceania, which is kind of you know, upper tier. It's really nice.
Right.
I get a nice big balcony and things like that. I only do one show instead of two seatings, two shows a night. It's one show a night. It's only one night a week, typically on any line. But then I'll do a lot of Celebrity and Royal Caribbean and Princess.
Oh, okay.
I did Carnival a couple of times. You know, they put me up in the nicest broom closet on the entire ship. So I don't know if I'll be back on Carnival anytime, but pretty much every cruise line treats me very well.
Yeah. Have you ever by any chance on any of your cruises run into a piano player named Hyperion Knight? Do you know him at all?
Hyperion. I think I would remember a Hyperion Knight. No.
Yeah, it's an unusual name. Well, he's a classical concert pianist, specializes in Rachmaninoff. And I met him on a cruise. I was on one of the Hillsdale College cruises as a speaker, and he was the piano player. Lo and behold, it turns out he's a conservative. He's a Ricochet reader. He's a Powerline reader. And you guys should be booked on the same cruise together sometime if this is a just world. I'll just plant that idea out there and maybe hype.
Do you recall what line it was? What line was
Well, yeah, it was the Crystal line is the one that Hillsdale uses.
Oh, yeah.
But I think he gets on a lot of them. So. Yeah, you'd have a good time, and he'd have a good time meeting you. Well, I tell you what, David, I think I will let you get off to the beer hall or whatever it is you do for recreation in Germany in the evening. Oh, I guess maybe one last question here. If you have thoughts on this, do you follow German politics while you're over there? I mean, I gather there's still not a government under Chancellor Merkel. She still can't put together a coalition. And you had this crazy story the other day about creating safe spaces for women on New Year's Eve because of the migrant problem. What are your observations on the scene there?
Well, I will say that before the election, there were billboards all over the place for the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland. And that, of course, is what is called the populist movement. That's to say Eurosceptic and skeptical about immigration. And their billboards, you know, consisted of they're quite – what's the word? They were striking, and that was by design, I think. It was just a couple of veiled women shopping. And if the intended effect was to make people think, boy, is this what we want? Do you want to, you know, women shopping in the grocery store and not being able to see their faces? And so it was a very powerful image, even if you're vehemently opposed to AfD, and, you know, good people are. I think you have to say that their political campaign was very effective. Having said that, I don't know if they can last if Merkel accommodates the immigration hawks, as we would call them, then they might, you know, lose their appeal to Germans. But right now, it seems, you know, that maybe that's the reason they're unable to form a government here, is that Merkel is not willing to really accommodate enough on the immigration issue, and things are at a stalemate.
An impasse, right. Well, the AFP went from something like, you know, no seats to 95 seats in the Bundestag in one election, which ought to send a message to somebody.
I do think, yeah, a lot of Germans are shocked. They thought that these, you know, sort of kooks, as it were, only, you know, existed in the hills of Pennsylvania and Ohio. People are beginning to realize that, you know, immigration is a legitimate issue. It's a national security issue, and that you don't need to be a xenophobe or a white nationalist or any kind of nationalist to deem it a legitimate issue and to have concerns.
Right. Oh, as John McLaughlin used to say, let's get out. Where do people find you? You have a website, is daviddeeble.com, right?
Yeah, that's probably the place. From there, you can learn, find all of my other social media links. It's daviddeeble.com. And right. The Twitter handle's also David Deeble, @DavidDeeble.
Right, which I highly recommend everyone sign up for. So with that, I'll press my button again.
That was easy.
Take care. Like, you see you in person sometime, David. Thanks very much.
All right. We'll touch base later. Thank you so much, Steve.
Powerline is a production of powerlineblog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.